This is a download from the BBC. Welcome to the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Helen Needham. For more information, visit our website at bbc.co.uk/Radio Scotland. This week, we're bringing you a special extended edition of the podcast. Now, you may remember back in July, we covered some of the route of the heroes of Robert Louis Stevenson's novel Kidnapped, from Eried on Mull through to the woods of Lettermore near Ballahoolish. Well, this week we're back on the Stevenson way again. So without further ado, let's hand over to the man in charge of our journey, Mark Stephen.
Hello, good morning, and a warm welcome to a special edition of Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, and this week we're going to bring you the second and final part of our series looking at Robert Louis Stevenson's novel Kidnapped and the Stevenson Way long-distance walking route, which is based upon the story. Now, Stevenson very cleverly conflates fact and fiction in Kidnapped. We've got the fictional hero, Lowlander David Balfour. He's shipwrecked off the island of Eried near Mull after being kidnapped with the intention of being sold as a slave to the colonies. Now, it's on the ship that he meets a real-life Jacobite hero, Alan Breck Stewart. After being shipwrecked, David gets himself off Eried and walks across Mull and then sails over to Morven on the mainland. He crosses Loch Linney to the woods of Lettermore, and it's there that he witnesses one of the most notorious murders in Scottish history, the Appin murder of 1752, where a government factor, the Red Fox, Colin Campbell of Glenure, is shot in broad daylight. Now, David, understandably, flees for fear of being implicated, and then he bumps into Alan again on the hill above the murder site. Alan tells David, look, come with me, and this is where the start of their main adventure together begins, the flight through the heather. Now, Alan Breck Stewart is the most wanted man in Scotland, and the redcoats are on his tail. Stevenson portrays him as a swashbuckling, multi-talented hero, but who was the real Alan Breck? Historian Ian Nimmo.
Alan Breck Stewart came from Rannoch in Breadalbane. But early on, he became a ward of James Stewart. He was a hero in Appin because he had stood by his clan chief through thick and thin. At the trial of James Stewart, Alan Breck was seen as a dark, sinister figure, a heavy drinker. He'd uttered threats against Glenure. And so he was made prime suspect. As the Jacobite courier, he flitted in and out of Scotland, almost like James Bond, at will. We don't know how many times. He would do a little recruiting for the French army and carry messages back and forward, and also, of course, take with him some money that he collected from Stuart's tenants, because in those days, feudal society, it was the way of the clans that they would wanted to see their clan chief in some decency in exile.
It was Alan's clan chief, James Stuart of the Glen, who was eventually hung for the Appin murder. Many say it was a terrible miscarriage of justice, and the real murderer remains a mystery to this day. So let's take up the tale as our two fugitives enter Glencoe, where I met the creator of the Stevenson Way, Ian Logan.
It found us in a prodigious valley, strewn with rocks and where ran a foaming river. Wild mountains stood around it. There grew neither grass nor trees. And I have sometimes thought since then that it may have been the valley called Glencoe, where the massacre was in the time of King William.
We've come up through the woods, and there's lots of larch nowadays. Scots pine, ash, rowan. There's foxgloves growing in amongst the bracken. And you make your way up. I mean, you're climbing all the time. You're not really aware of it, but you're climbing all the time. And you come out at this big hummock of rock. And it's basically, it's about the size of a small cottage.
It's a good size. And it sits above every bit around here. You'd actually have to be up halfway up the Clachay Gully, for example, to be able to see down on top of this rock.
Mm-hmm. This is coming up to the top, Signal Rock now. Up the steps. The rock we're standing on is twisted and convoluted, and somebody's taken slabs of that and created steps, which is really quite handy. Difficult for us to imagine now, because there's modern plantings of hazel and rowan and ash, but strip this away and effectively you've got a 360 degree panorama here.
Yes, it's lovely landscape. You've got the rugged cliffs of Glencoe over there and the Munros, And we can't see Biddy and Nambian, which is just at the back there. But over there is Benmore Chalam, which is mentioned in the book, and that's where the way would come down through that valley over there. And you can see here, quite clearly from here, how the land all around it looks down on it.
Hopeless for hiding on.
Yeah. But from here, we are above everything, which is okay. And until you, as I camped just over there with my tarp tent, and I'd lost my billy can down that slope, and it went away down. And it was fun hunting for it.
There's an echo here of what happens in the book, because they find themselves on top of this stone. They're being chased by redcoats. The redcoats are down on our left-hand side here in the burn. Now, you can hear the burn from where we are. Mm. They've got a blistering hot day. And Davy says to Alan Breck, what are we going to do? And he says, well, we've got no option. We're here till night. We've got to lie here in Bursal. Now, Bursal is basically just cook. You know, and he goes on to say, that one good Scotch word, Bursal, was indeed the most of the story. You are to remember that we lay on the bare top of a rock like scones upon a girdle. The sun beat upon us cruelly. The rock grew so heated, a man could scarcely endure the touch of it. And the little patch of earth and fern which kept cooler was only large enough for one at a time. And they can hear the burn from here. They're here for hours.
Yeah, and they can hear the soldiers around. And this is where also Stevenson drops in a little snippet when Davy hears his first English voice about this Englishman touching the rock and exclaiming how hot it was. In English, of course.
Yeah. So again, I was amazed at the clipping tones and the odd sing-song in which he spoke, and this trick of dropping the letter H. We've got an hope. But it's called Signal Rock. Why is it called Signal Rock?
Well, this is where they believe the massacre of Glencoe was signalled from, that the soldiers, when they saw the light from this rock, then started massacring the people that they were staying with, the women, the children, the men, those that were looking after them. Mm. So this is the place where it happened from. You can see up the glen that way, and you can see down to the village this way as well, Glencoe Village. So it's quite a good little spot on either side, and it's high up.
It would do the job.
Yes.
Right. Eventually, later in the afternoon, the soldiers are tired, are sleepy. Our two heroes escape off this. They slip down the shadowed side of the rock and start to make their way where?
They're heading up and over towards Coalas and the Coen, which really means then they're heading up and over towards the Papa Glencoe. You're looking at the Beulach between the Papa Glencoe and the Monroe over there. So they're heading up the hill, quite a steep hill, but Stevenson has them going up, up, up and up and over and then down.
Let's follow their example.
Right. At the moment, we've just walked up from the main road into the glen above Coalas na Coen. This is where, in the book, Davy and Alan hid out for a few days, but Alan practised sword fighting, etc., with Davy. But also, in real life, Alan Breck hid here while waiting for some money and maybe even some more clothes. You never know. We can see in front of us all the slope down towards Lochleven. But behind us, it's relatively flat. There's this lovely glen, and then it goes right up into the mountains. We're at the back of the Papa Glencoe, and it would be very easy for him just to disappear up there, and you wouldn't find him at all. So if he sees any soldiers down there coming his way, boomf, he's gone.
Just what's like across the other side of the loch there is probably more akin to what would have been here back in the 1750s. It's that sort of open woodland.
Yes.
And the rocks stick out of it and things. The bit that you refer to is here, the glen, it's almost a little hollow. Now, we've only come up, 400 feet from the road, maybe five. You can't hear the road. You can't see anything. You could hide up here for a good long while, particularly if it was a bit more cover. You know, we were talking earlier about the fact it was the first time in the book where he'd heard English accents. Mm-hmm. Somebody come out of London wearing a red coat, you know, and a stiff stock collar.
Yeah.
It's just hard going.
Yeah. The culture, the food, the weather, everything. The midges, yes, would just be a shock to the system.
The route you've put together, based on Kidnapped, I mean, you're starting off in the island of Erid, as we did, working your way through Mull, Morven, across here, across Loch Linnhe, into this area. Effectively, we've hit about the halfway point at the moment. What kind of person do you think will do that long-distance way? Who are you trying to attract?
Really, it's those that want more of a challenge, those that want to get away from the usual waymarked paths. It's folk that want to think, I want to try something different. And make it a challenge. Well, it is a challenge, really, because you have to know your map and compass. You need to know what you're doing. In a place like this, if the mist came down, as it often does, you could very easily get lost, disorientated. You don't know which way you're going, because, as you said, you can't hear anything. You don't know where the road is, etc. OK, you might have a map and a compass to help you, but you need to understand how they're used. And in Scotland, you up in Monroe, you've got a 50-50 chance of the mist or the rain or the Clyde coming in. So you need to know what you're doing.
As you say, it's you've got to know map, you've got to know compass. You've got to be reasonably self-reliant and take your cue from David Balfour and Alan Breck-Stewart. Be prepared to rough it a bit.
Yes.
Come down off the crest of the hill, and we know there's a burn down there because we can hear the burn down there, but you can't actually see it through the birch. And even up here there's mountain ash rowan growing just 4 or 5 feet away, and it's quite a steep slope. It must be about 70 degrees down into that, but you can see how this could become their sanctuary for that short period of time, those 4 or 5 days while they're waiting for help. You know, they're guddling for trout in the burn, these little quarter pounders, you know, not big but delicious, you know, when they're cooked. And I must say, I never really tried dramach. That was, is it?
Pinmeal, oatmeal, and cold water, and that's it. Or I suppose you can heat it up and make it more of a meal, but they couldn't do that too much. Although up here, you'd be able to put a light a fire. And you'd probably get away with it not being seen too much. That would work, particularly if you were down there and you lit it in the trees, because then the trees would then tend to hide the smoke and filter it away. So it's a nice, safe, sheltered location, ideal for the two of them as they learn, as David Balfour learned how to wield a sword. And they were playing sword play and just having a good time. Relaxing.
Well, as you were saying, I mean, he never really got the hang of it. You said he discovered that 60% of it was standing there with a fearsome, confident aspect, you know, looking the part, you know, in front of your enemy. No, it's just extraordinary that we could be so close to civilization here and in a completely different world.
It would be just so easy right now just to lay back in the heather and just fall asleep.
There's a fair chance if you lay back in this heather, we'd have to dig you out of it. 9/10 boggy.
At this point, Stevenson makes, in the middle of his great long passage, because he's a great writer of territory being covered, but in the middle of this story of constant movement and progress, he designs a beautiful eddy of stillness, an idyll, as you might say, of retreat, where they're hiding out for the dust to settle after this assassination.
Sculptor Sandy Stoddart.
Then Alan says, "It's high time we were out of this place and getting to the south." And so he says, "We've got to get money for this. And to get money, we'll have to get a message to my kinsman." And David then thinks that by making gunpowder ink, they could possibly write him a note. And Alan says, "Well, we could, and we could deliver that by cover of night. But the trouble is, we'd be a long time in getting a reply, because my kinsman would have to go to the school to learn English and to read and write, and we're kind of pressed for time." So then Alan goes to the fire and brings out two little pieces of wood, burnt at the ends. Then he binds them with some fabric taken from the tail of his coat, made a cross out of it, and then he's put a sprig of pine and birch into the binding, and then integrated into the binding one of his buttons from his coat. And the button has a escutcheon on it that indicates Alan Breck's father. And with this talisman, he will go down, cover of night, to the village and leave it in his kinsman's windowsill. David Balfour looks at this with incredulity. What possible message has been given with this thing? Because for David Balfour and his like, the only conveyor of culture is that with the ink and the quill, that writing saves the day. And this, of course, is a fundamental Whigamore view, whereas Alan belongs to a more sophisticated people, more nuanced kind of people. And he says, "My way of thinking about this talisman is this. My kinsman will see this cross and know that something is up, for it is in the way of being a fiery cross or a cross tarry, which is held aloft and run through the villages when we are to be in uprising. But we are not to be in uprising, for he has not heard. But he will still know by virtue of the cross that there is something. Then he will see the button, which he will know belongs to my father, and will then know that my father is dead, and so then, as it were by default, will assume it is I, because of course dynastics in Alan's outlook are all important. Your ancestors are perpetually with you. And then he'll say, Alan Breck Stewart. And he'll see the cross and he'll think, Alan Breck Stewart requires me to rise for him. And then he'll see the sprig of birch and he'll see the sprig of pine. A mix of tree that's no mickle rife in these parts. In other words, these two trees do not commonly grow together. But Alan, you see, with perceptual power, has noticed that this wood, which David just thinks is any old wood, has in fact got this strange species feature. And so therefore has chosen to signify the wood in terms of its distinctive and strange mix of tree. This will then be taken down and placed, and hopefully it will awaken the knowledge.
The following day, up he comes, wandering away. And so they meet and they talk and he gets his money and so on. So they then move on from here towards Kinlochleven. And then that's your last shop before you hit Strathire. A long way in between. About 8 to 10 days walking in between. So it's not a light undertaking going that way into the big bad land of Rannoch Moor.
But you'll not forget it.
Oh, it's lovely. It's beautiful. The world, you know, the isolation, the real sense of being nowhere, in the middle of nowhere. It's wonderful, yeah.
So eventually, David Balfour and Alan Breck Stewart find themselves just at the edge of Rannoch Moor. And it says, the mist rose and died away and showed us that country lying as waste as the sea, only the moorfowl and the peewees crying upon it, and far over to the east a herd of deer moving like dots. Much of it was red with heather, much of the rest broken up with bogs and hags and peaty pools. Some had been burnt black in a heath fire, and in another place there was quite a forest of dead firs standing like skeletons. A wearier-looking desert man never saw. But at least it was cleared of troops, which was our point. We're actually standing on that moor now with Jern Robinson, who's the manager of the Loch Hushan Youth Hostel. It's a perfect description, really, isn't it? It's what we're standing in.
It's interesting the way that it's called desert and considered to be a desert. But in lots of ways, it's very, very full of life that are perfectly attuned to this environment. Certainly Loch Ossian is full of birds. There are mergansers and black-throated divers, possibly even on this little loch in here. Lots of different kinds of ducks, different kinds of waders, golden plovers, and occasionally we see an osprey over Loch Ossian. So if you look and kind of keep quiet, sometimes you realise that it's actually a very complicated environment, yeah.
We stayed in the youth hostel last night, and after dinner I went out for a wander just round the shore of Loch Ossian, and first thing I saw was a peregrine. It came up and shot across the loch and disappeared behind the trees. And there was mallard with chicks and things like that. I went out last thing at night just to soak in the silence more than anything else. There was toads moving across the grass. As you say, I mean, it's not a desert. It's absolutely full of life. And yet, it is so alien to what most people experience nowadays. This is one of the few places in Scotland, I think, most people would stand on the outskirts of and think twice before going into.
Well, certainly if you are considering going into it, you need to have a bit of a clue of what you're doing in terms of navigation and map reading, and probably to have a hearty companion with you.
Not necessarily armed, but fair enough.
Because, if it does get misty here or the weather comes in, it can get serious very quickly.
You've got to think twice about going across Rannoch Moor. You take your safety into your own hands. In Ben Alder, even a really remote, seriously high mountain beside Loch Erecht. I mean, I've gone across there in the winter with an ice axe with about 3 feet of green ice on the top and the ice axe hardly holding me because we're getting blown across it in the wind. But we're under control. But you, before you set out, you've really got to make sure that you know what you're doing and you've got all the aids that you need. It's not, as I say, it's not a stroll in the park.
You were telling me earlier about crossing Rannoch Moor one winter's night when you just run out of light, essentially. How did you navigate?
Well, it was one of these came up out of the blue. We were following the route, but from the opposite direction. And we'd spent the night in Alder Cottage and came down to Rannoch Station. And we thought, will we spend the night in Rannoch Station or will we push on 12 miles to Glencoe? And we decided to push on. And as happens in Rannoch Moor, suddenly the weather changed and down came a blizzard. It tore the map straight out of my hands and it disappeared into the unknown. And the way we got over, because we were equipped, we did have torches, and there's pylons going right across Rannoch Moor. And because of previous experience, we knew exactly where these pylons went. And we shone our torches up onto the lines of the pylon. You could hardly even see these just in the blizzard. And eventually, it eased just a little bit, and we saw a little light in the distance. It was Black Corrie's farm, and we had a night in Black Corrie's farm. I remember the farmer at the time saying, "Where have you come from? Not the moor." And that's exactly where we'd come from.
In Kidnapped, they move their way through this environment. They end up in Ben Alder, in Clooney's cage, you know, with the clan chieftain Clooney. You know, there's a marvellous description of these tree trunks that have been woven together with wattle. And the house is behind this, and it's egg-shaped, this great hall. It's almost like Lord of the Rings, to a certain extent, the way they describe it. People lived in this landscape. You know, this was not just a threat, it was a refuge to a lot of people, too.
You could actually see it like that now, in some ways. A lot of people who come to the hostel are people who work very hard and maybe have quite difficult lives or quite stressful lives in the cities, because of course it's quite easy to get here from Edinburgh or Glasgow. And I sometimes get the distinct impression that it's a refuge for them. Mm-hmm. The quiet and the absence of vehicles and the whole kind of calmness and natural wilderness.
Just across the other side of this wee lock in there, you've got the railway line, and that's why it's so easy. You know, you can come from London, Glasgow, Edinburgh, wherever, to actually get here, and you're on the outskirts of a wilderness. It's fantastic.
It is fantastic.
Once you get your eye in, there's a tremendous amount of wild flowers here too.
There's tormentil and fleabane and lady's bedstraw. And the lovely harebell, Scottish bluebell, I guess it is.
One of the main features for me of this landscape, we've just come across here, is the rocks are covered with these enormous pillows of moss. I mean, I'm sticking my fingers into that, and I can't get to the bottom of it. And this stuff here is reindeer moss. Your reindeer should be in this environment, and it's just beautiful stuff. You know, it's almost ghostly against the sort of dark mosses that you get.
It's wonderful stuff.
Yeah. We've come off the moor proper now, and we're just standing above the youth hostel, which sits on the banks of Loch Ossian. And, Jan, I mean, it's dotted around with trees, and there's all these wee islands, and they've got trees on them, but really, at this end of the loch, they are the only trees that, you know, that are here. What is it that down that direction? That's probably west, I'm guessing.
Well, now, there's the station house, and there's Corowa Station, which is the highest station, I think, in the UK, 408 metres. Before the station was built, I suppose that was the major route out to the west. You can see Ben Nevis from here. Uh-huh. And there are
routes.
You
could do if it was a bit clearer.
Yeah. And there are routes out to Kinlochleven and Spean Bridge out that way, yeah.
So David Balfour and Alan would have come out from somewhere in the west, may have come onto the moor further south.
It's unlikely, I would have thought, they would stick to the moor, because, I mean, as it says in the book, it's so open. I mean, they're really worried about being spotted by redcoats. The redcoats had ponies. You know, they could have been chased across that. There's no hiding place, essentially. It's flat open. So if they come up here, effectively, they're working up the way up the side of Loch Ossian, and that end is what, Ben Alder?
The Ben Alder group, yeah. So I suppose once you get into that, there'd be caves and nooks and crannies that they could have hidden in.
Yeah. Well, they've got, you know, in the book, they've got Clooney's cage. You know, they meet the clan chieftain Clooney there, across the other side, Loch Eric, and then from there, you're off and away, essentially. You're listening to a special edition of Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, and today I'm continuing my journey along the Stevenson Way, following the route David Balfour and Alan Breck Stewart took from Erid, that's just off Mull, to Carstorphan in Edinburgh in Robert Louis Stevenson's novel Kidnapped. Now, although the area our two heroes cross from Rannoch Moor over the tops to Loch Lyon and down here to Buckwidder is enormous, Stevenson actually describes the route in just a couple of pages in Kidnapped. Now, this is a much-discussed part of the route. Where did Stevenson mean them to go? Up onto Benmoor, Stobinian, round the bottom? Whatever, in the book, it's certainly a miserable time for David. He was still livid with Alan after he gambled away all his money at Clooney's cave. He was also becoming increasingly unwell. He says, and I'm quoting here, that he could lie down and die on these wet mountains like a sheep or a fox, and my bones must whiten there like the bones of a beast. Now, things come to a head, and David actually draws his sword on Alan. Alan, because it's a young man and because he's unwell, can't bring himself to fight him, and eventually David sort of collapses and just has to submit, ask for help from Alan. So the old man carries the younger man on his back down here into Kirkton of Balquhidder, which is where I'm going to join up with Peter Lorry, who's a historian of the Clan MacGregor. We're heading down this trail at the moment towards Balquhidder, towards the Kirk. And nowadays, it's big, mature, coniferous trees. Sycamore, there's a sort of architectural remains of foxgloves there, like a fantastic scent of pine.
When you read Johnson's account, for instance, a little bit later in the 1780s, when he came round, most of the hillsides were bare because the trees had been felled, both for building material and firewood, and of course they were heavily grazed by cattle. So there wasn't really a chance for the new growth to come up. Most of the trees that you see in the Highlands today started towards the end of the 18th century when you had the Murrays, for instance, the Dukes of Atholl, planting millions of trees. And of course, in modern terms, this is a forestry commission.
Now, in the book, Kidnapped, they find shelter in the house of Duncan Dhu McLaren's house, and David spends about a month there recovering whilst Alan hides in the woods by day and then visits the house at night. Everybody in the area must have known who they were. Bills out for them, there was descriptions of them, but they're left alone. Why? Why is this a safe haven?
Well, you tended to find that in the Highlands. It wasn't quite the 100% that the romantic novelists have put out. There was an element of betrayal, but when people did betray, it was something remarkable. It was something that people spoke about. Mm-hmm. So the norm was, no, if you gave hospitality to somebody, you didn't betray them. And that didn't necessarily just apply to the individual householder, but to the community as well.
Again, this is a pretty good track we're walking on here, but in the book, David Balfour's on his last legs. He's extremely unwell. Alan Breck Stewart supposedly carries him on his back down here in the dark. Yeah. A reasonable feat.
Well, I think so. It's a cattle trail. So, I mean, if you've been walking up to your knees in gore from cattle and so on, you can imagine what it was like. Cattle don't climb mountains. Cattle will go the easiest route. And this was the kind of route that the cattle drovers would have taken.
Again, we come back to this point of, you know, of 21st century sensibilities. We tend to think in terms of, is it the end of a good road? Is it on a through route or whatever? This feels nowadays like a dead end. But back in 1751?
No, definitely not. Balquhidder was like a crossing point. There are drove routes throughout Balquhidder. At the top end of the glen, you can get down to Glenfalloch at the head of Loch Lomond. Directly opposite here at the church, you're into Glenbucky, which takes you down to Loch Venica, Brigaturk. The route we're on at the moment, we're walking down the hill here, takes you over to Glendochart, and there's two others further up the glen where you can get across to Glendochart. So it's really a through route, and it would be full of cattle.
So this is a motorway service station, yes. Of 1751, yes. Basically. I mean, this is busy.
Yes, the drovers would be coming in here with their cattle, and they'd be staying the night here, and then moving on the next day.
Coming up into the cemetery now at Belquidda Parish Church, and I'm ashamed to say I've never actually been here before. It's a lovely church. There's the remnants of the old church there, and obviously it's an old cemetery. Some very old gravestones here. David Balfour and Alan Breck-Stewart come down out of the glens into this area. The first door they knock on is Duncan Dhu McLaren's house. David rests up there, Alan's hiding in the woods, coming back. Then this character Robin Oig turns up. And there's a face-off between Alan Breck-Stewart and Robin Oig. Now, is that likely to have happened, or is it artistic license?
I think it's a combination of both. There's a good reason for Alan Breck and Robin Oig to be hostile to each other. The reason for the dispute is that in 1734, Robin Oig's father, Rob Roy MacGregor, had a farm at the other end of Loch Boyle, about 5 miles from here, further up the glen, at Inverlochlarrick. And MacLaren was given the tenure, which Rob Roy was rather upset about. Rob Roy said, let's settle this by combat, so we'll have a sword fight, not to the death, but, you know, to the first injury. Now, although Invernenty was half Rob Roy's age, Rob Roy had a reputation as a noted sword fighter. He was 60 years old at this point. So Invernenty, of course, didn't want to do this. So he thought, I need a champion. So he got Stuart of Ardshiel to be his champion to fight Rob Roy on his behalf. So there was the fight. Rob Roy was injured, he was a sword cut. Now, sword cuts are usually quite clean, but Rob Roy took an infection from this, and he died a few weeks later. Now, at that point, Robin Oig was about 17 years old, he was a young man. 2 years later, in 1736, he shoots Invernenty dead, and then goes into hiding. We find Robin Oig suddenly appear here, probably staying with his brother. He meets up with Alan Breck, who is the brother of Ardshiel, who'd killed his father. So hence, Stevenson would have said, this is the reason for them coming to conflict.
It's a great part of the book, this. So you've got David Balfour, Alan Breck-Stewart in Duncan Dhu McLaren's house. Robin Oig turns up. They bristle. I mean, they're sort of like two fighting cocks. And they say, look, let's no sword play. Here's the pipes. Let's sort it out this way. We'll take it, you know, we'll work it out in the pipes. And Alan plays, and then Robin plays, and then Alan plays again, and then Robin plays. And he says he only held out his hand as if to ask for silence and struck into the slow measure of a pibroch. It was a fine piece of music in itself and nobly played, but it seems besides it was a piece peculiar to the Appin Stewarts and a chief favourite with Alan. The first notes were scarce out before there came a change in his face. When the time quickened, he seemed to grow restless in his seat, and long before that piece was at an end, the last signs of his anger died from him, and he'd no thought but for the music. Robin Oig, he said when it was done, you're a great piper. I'm not fit to blow in the same kingdom with you. Body of me, you have mair music in your sporran than I have in my head. Lovely. Nonsense, probably, horse feathers, but I like it.
It could be some truth in it. We're not completely sure. We don't know so much about Robin Oig, but we certainly know that James Moore was a piper, because one of the last...
His brother.
So one of the last letters we have from James Moore, when he was in Dunkirk in the 1754 or thereabouts, is saying, please send me a set of pipes so I can console myself. So he's so into the pipes that he wants them, you know, in his last days, so he can play his music and, you know, remember his past. And Robin Oig was probably the same.
These grave slabs lie together. So there's mother, son, and Rob Roy in the centre of them. There's a very unusual gravestone at the end of it, made out of lumps of white quartz, For some reason, folk have been laying money on these things.
Oh, yes.
Why?
It happens all the time.
But why?
It happens all the time. People come along, they've maybe seen the Rob Roy movie and all the rest of it, and every year, in fact, the minister collects these and puts it in the church fund, but the slab you see at the end with MacGregor despite them is modern. That's early 20th century. And the late 19th century for this ironwork around it.
And where is Robin Oike actually buried here?
That's an interesting one, because we know he was hanged in Edinburgh in, I think, January or February 1754, and it says in the account that his relatives took the body away, but we don't know where they put it.
Okay. And what was he hanged for?
He was hanged for the kidnap of Jean Key, kidnap and forcible marriage, which happened in 1751.
Yeah. Was that really what he was hanged for, or were there political motives behind it?
There were probably political motives behind it. They wanted to make examples of the MacGregors. We were still a banned clan from 1603. The MacGregors had been an illegal organisation. We didn't have our name restored to us till 1774, which is 20 years after this.
I have to say, coming back to Stevenson and coming back to Kidnapped, the more you know about this, the more impressed you are at the fact that, I mean, he's done a brilliant job of turning an already brilliant story, of taking all these various parts and squeezing them into one sort of homogenous whole.
Yes.
And making something really wonderful out of it. But what he started off with was already wonderful. It was different.
Oh yes, it was known. It was known. It wasn't as if something he'd dreamed up. But in general, he's taken historical facts that quite a lot of people would have been aware of, and he's weaved them together into a novel.
I've moved on now, more towards Stirling area. David Balfour and Alan Breck-Stewart stay for about a month in Balquhidder, and then they head south. Now, the clothes are more or less in tatters, the money's all gone, but Alan feels that by this time, that's about 4 months after the Appin murder, the hunt for them must have greatly slackened, and he says it's a chief principle in military affairs to go where you're least expected. Forth is our trouble, you ken the saying, forth bridles the wild Hielanmen. So they head directly for Stirling Bridge. Now they came to the edge of the hills over the Castle of Stirling, they made camp on an islet in the island water in plain view of Stirling Castle, where apparently they could hear the drums beat as some part of the garrison paraded. Now interestingly, by now Robert Louis Stevenson is back on familiar territory, because apparently the Spa at Bridge of Allen was a favourite holiday destination of the family, because it was hoped that the Spa waters would improve the health of Robert and his mother. I'm actually standing on one version of Stirling Bridge at the moment with medieval historian Fiona Watson. It's a great part of the story, but would the bridge we're standing on at the moment, this little old stone bridge with the cobbles running across it and things and these high parapets, would this have been the bridge?
This would be the one. This is the one that was built again after Wallace, or the English army, destroyed it in 1297. So, yeah, this is the bridge for the Borough of Stirling.
This is the actual one.
The bridge is close under the castle hill, an old, high, narrow bridge with pinnacles along the parapet. And you may conceive with how much interest I looked upon it, not only as a place famous in history, but as the very doors of salvation to Alan and myself.
So the words there of Davy Balfour. He hears the drums, etc., from up in the castle. He knows there's a garrison up there. Who would have been up in the castle at the time?
Well, from the 18th century, it's the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, which, as you know, Argyll is very important to the story of the Appin murder. So, yes, it would be sort of doubly cruel, if you like, the fact that it's Argyll's men who are sitting up. You can't get away from them.
Yeah, wherever you go, they're on your trail.
And just then, "Who goes?" cried a voice, and we heard the butt of a musket rattle on the stones. I must suppose the sentry had been sleeping, so that had we tried, we might have passed unseen. But he was awake now, and the chance forfeited.
Forward! Row!
So just to recap, Alan and David have missed a chance to cross the Forth at Stirling Bridge. They walk their way right along the foot of the Ochils. Again, there's very little description from Robert Louis Stevenson on that. They go through Clickmannan and they end up at a place called Limekilns on the Forth. Now again, David is dreaming of being at the other side of the Forth at Queensferry to claim his fortune, and he says, "Here I was, upon the north, clad in poor enough attire of an outlandish fashion, with 3 silver shillings left to me of all my fortune, a price set upon my head, and an outlawed man for my sole company." Now, when they reach Limekilns, they find a small pub. They get some bread, cheese and ale off this fine-looking lassie. And there's a really nice bit in the book where Alan decides to use David, the young David, well-put-together loon, as bait to secure the services of this lassie. She's got to feel sorry for him, Alan says. And he says again, you have a fine, hangdog, rag and tatter, clapper-my-claw kind of look to you, as if you'd stolen the coat from a tatty bogle. There's some play acting. David pretends to be unwell. Alan charms the lassie by whistling Charlie is my darling and chatting her up. And somehow she gets taken in by this nonsense, and she comes to them in a rowing boat late at night, and she rows them across the Forth. But the question I was asking was, is this actually feasible? Well, as you can probably hear, we're on a rowing boat at the moment. Tony Jones is sitting behind me from the South Queensbury Rowing Club. Is it possible? Could she have done it?
I think it's perfectly possible, yes. She just needs to get out and row. All these folk knew the river and knew the environs, so yes, not a problem.
Would you need to go at a particular point in the tide, or could you cross the river at any stage?
With these people who lived on the river and rode on the river every day, they would know the tides, know the weather, and they wouldn't have a problem with rowing distances at any state of the tide or up to reasonable amount of weather.
We're in a four-man skiff at the moment, just heading off underneath the Forth Road Bridge. It's slightly going in circles because it's a four-man skiff and I'm not doing any rowing. It's a bit of a struggle for the rest of you. But, I mean, a lassie by herself, could she have done it?
I think that the people at that time would have been fit enough and so used to the water and the weather that they could have quite easily rowed across the Forth at that time, yes.
On the bench in front of me, I've got Andy Jarvis. What is it like actually rowing on the Forth? Because it's kind of a busy river sometimes.
Well, you just have to be careful, and before you go out, you know where the tide is and what the wind's doing and what the crew are like. We get a lot of new members, so we don't take new members places that we don't get back from. You know, you could go down river when the tide's going out and the wind's against you, and you would have difficulty getting back.
I've been out here in things like little catamarans where it's been blowing an absolute hoolie, and it can get pretty wild out here.
Yes, particularly around about the bridge pillars and things. It's a wee bit like a maelstrom sometimes. So you kind of get used to it now, you know.
Well, we've given up on rowing. Well, I've never started rowing. You've given up on rowing. Andy's still rowing. Siobhan's still rowing. Our cox at the front there is doing absolutely nothing as far as I can see. Well, I take a turn at the oar. All right. As you can tell, I now can't talk and row at the same time because it's too much coordination. But it's a bit like patting your head and rubbing your tummy. It's impossible. But it's surprising how much power you can actually generate with these things. Not that I'm doing any of it, but the rest of them are doing extremely well. Oh dear me, that was terrible. It's a pretty good day for this. It's reasonably flat, calm. But this is a very different environment to that which Alan Breck Stewart and David Balfour would have encountered. Because, of course, no road bridge, no rail bridge, no ferry terminal across there. North Queensbury, I don't know how much of that existed. South Queensbury definitely was, that's what we're heading for at the moment. In fact, the bow's pointed almost exactly at the Hawes Inn, which of course is where all this story started off from. It's a great pity that this radio wasn't in smelly vision, because there's a fantastic smell of the tangle coming off the Forth, that real sort of brine smell you get with salt water. Standing between the two bridges, the Forth Bridge and of course the proper bridge, the rail bridge. There's a train going across that at the moment. And here in South Queensbury, it's still mobbed with tourists, sun shining, and just seagulls and black-headed gulls creaking away in the shoreline there, looking for the odd dollop of ice cream that's fallen off some kid's cone. And this is where David Balfour comes back to with Alan Breck Stewart. Of course, he was kidnapped from here, and he makes his way back here. Of course, by the time they come back, they're in rags, they're exhausted, they've run out of money, And this is where he starts wandering about, trying to find the lawyer, Ran Keeler, who theoretically can restore him to his inheritance.
The first thing that David Balfour had to do was establish his credentials with his lawyer, Ran Keeler. He'd arrived out of the mountains in a state of raggedness. And the best way to do that would be to confront his bad old uncle Ebenezer at the House of Shaws. They worked out a plan that Alan Breck would do the confrontation while Ran Keeler and David hid in the bushes listening to every word. Alan teased the truth out of Uncle Ebenezer like a professional. And at one point, Uncle Ebenezer got really upset and he's standing there at the window with his blunderbuss. And he says, "Where would I be with my blunderbuss and you and your sword?" And Alan goes on to say, "Before your doddering old fingers could find a trigger, the hilt of my sword would be dirling in your breastbone," or words to that effect. But that was it. The truth was then out. And afterwards, there was a time of parting about to come. And they left the Queensferry and headed up, probably along the seafront, up to Kirstorfin Hill. And it was partly a silent journey. They had already made their plans what they were going to do when the time to part had come. It was silent because they were desperately sad and upset at having, after all these wonderful adventures, had at last come to an end.
They end up here at the Rest and Be Thankful. And they're looking down, well, they're not looking down in the Edinburgh we can see now.
No, they were looking down in the old walled city of Edinburgh, with little villages and big houses scattered all around. But at that time, the new town wasn't built. The rest of Edinburgh, which had gobbled up all these surrounding villages as it developed, was just non-existent. And it's interesting, in the year when Alan Breck was involved in the Appin murder, was exactly the same year when Edinburgh Council had its proposals for a new town of Edinburgh, which would jump the Nor Loch and build Prince's Street, and as we know it, on that ridge. So they had a marvellous view, as you can see, from the Rest and Be Thankful.
The parting here, I think, is one of the most moving pieces of writing I've ever come across, because, you know, there's an age difference between them, but they've built up a friendship, they've built up a mutual respect, they've been through a tremendous amount together. And it gets here, and it is all the better for the fact that it's not expressed. That, you know, there are no words. There's just this business of them more or less parting in silence, and this rather embarrassed handshake, and goodbye, and goodbye, and then off they go, and no looking back.
That's right, and David, I think all they said was goodbye. They walked down, or David walked down the hill. Alan Breck went over to find his haystack in Silver Mills. David walked down the hill with a heavy, heavy heart, and at one point he said he just sat down there and he could grat like any baby.
Probably here, we've come off the hill now, and we're down beside Kirstorfin Road. It's pretty noisy. And we're beside this statue of David Balfour and Alan Breck Stewart. I have to say, this is probably my favourite statue in Scotland. I love this one.
Well, look at Alan Breck's face. Have you ever seen a better sculpted face than that? That is Alan Breck.
Yeah.
Wonderful. It's interesting that an amusing aside to all this is that it's 1.5 times life size. And it was too big to be fired in Scotland, so they took it down to England and they brought it back to Scotland in the back of a lorry. And it was standing upright. And of course, as they passed, it looked as if Alan Breck was waving to all and sundry along the road.
Giving
and
a
they
benediction.
Waved back. And everywhere they went, as it got darkest particularly, there was wavings all the way back. We stopped at the border and opened a bottle of whiskey. Because Alan Breck is home. And a further aside is that when it got here, it was brought here in darkness because it was all top secret, waiting for the time when Sean Connery would come and open it. So they couldn't let it, you know, they had to build a wooden scaffold around it so nobody could see what it was. But Sean Connery was a long time in making up his mind when he could come. And people wondered what on earth this was. They thought it was a bit of modern sculpture that had been some leakages to the press. And it stood here, I think, for about a year in just a wooden box. And then Sean Connery came and opened it. Yes.
Well, it's a fabulous piece of work. Not just the two figures, but the maquette of Robert Louis Stevenson, which is it's actually much more manly and more heroic than you normally see him portrayed. Yeah. And, of course, it's the work of brilliant sculptor Sandy Stoddart. And I went to talk to him at Paisley.
When you look at David Balfour and his alternative, which is Alan Breck Stewart, you see not only a cultural divide, also an ethnic divide, an historical divide, and you also see a divide of ethos. The optimistic character is not Alan Breck Stewart, who was historical. Mm-hmm. He is the deeply pessimistic character. He is fated to end in exile and was possibly executed during the terror in the French Revolution. Walter Scott had a correspondent who thought he met him in a military hospital, I mean in the old sense of the word, watching one of the parades, one of the revolutionary parades going past. And there's reason to believe that there's a possible execution that was ordered because, of course, he belonged to the aristocratic party. David Balfour, on the other hand, he is the real optimist. He is the man with a future. So you might say that David Balfour represents the real powerhouse of the two, and that Alan Breck is a far more noble, thus redundant character, facing exile and destitution and finally nothing. And it's David Balfour that's on the make. So, powerful figure, lithe, energetic, and of course, in this context, looking up.
He's like a male model standing there. Though.
Yes.
You know, it's almost shiny Teflon-like.
Yes. But you see, this is appropriate. Remember, David Balfour is likely to have enjoyed a past of some nutritional credibility, as opposed to Alan Breck. Yeah. His Breck means, of course, is pockmarked, you know, with the smallpox, and therefore you might imagine a man who has come from a context where there's a massive overuse of alcohol and tobacco, compared with the Whig David Balfour, where Puritanism, he's a right neocrom, you see, and therefore he's likely to be strong in limb. That's also part of that unscrupulous optimism that I talk about.
The quite brilliant Sandy Stoddart there, sculptor who created that wonderful statue of David Balfour and Alan Breck Stewart that we can see just across the road here in Kirstorfen. And I'm back here with Ian Nimmo. And Ian, I love this idea. It's a great story. Wonderful that Ian Logan took this story and has imprinted it on a map of Scotland and said to people, look, follow this, experience this for yourself, because it passes through some superb terrain.
Well, it does. I mean, the finest terrain in Scotland. I mean, you think of Erid. Think of coming along Loch Screedon side, over Mull. Down along that little known area, on the north side of Loch Linnhe. Across Glencoe. I mean, Glencoe is something ferocious. That's SAS stuff in Glencoe. Yeah. And then out across Rannoch Moor to Ben Olver, in one of the most remotest mountains in Scotland. There's badlands as you come down towards Stirling, and then along the Forth into the softer country, and then the full stop is here. Yeah.
We have thoroughly enjoyed the bits of it that we've been able to do. We haven't been able to do all of it, because it is a fair distance. It'll take you about 2 weeks, probably, to do it from stem to stem. You may have noticed that we haven't actually told you what the absolute ending of the book is, and that's quite deliberate. It's a cracking story. I wouldn't want to deprive you of the pleasure of actually reading it, so go and get the book and read it for yourself. From myself, Mark Stephen, from the production team, from Ian Nimmo, Ian Logan, everybody else that's taken part, thank you very much for listening.